We want to welcome you to this edition of Gathering Storm. And we have Andy Woods, Dr. Andy Woods, and we're going to be looking at the issue of preterism. Now, what in the world is preterism? And what's that all about? Would you believe that this is a burning, fiery issue among evangelicals and Christians today on the issue of preterism? Now, here we're talking about a subject that many of you have never even heard what the word is or heard the word or what it's about. But it turns out to be one of the most important burning issues of our day. Dr. Woods has done his doctoral dissertation on the subject. So we're going to go right to the horse's mouth and take a look at what preterism is all about, what it means, and what's happening with it today. And one of the things I want to ask Andy to really elaborate on is why do people gravitate to the doctrine of preterism. Now, hold on to your seats. If you know nothing about it, don't turn the CD off. Listen to what we're going to say, because as I'm telling you, this could be one of the most important subjects that you'll hear about for some time. Andy, I want to welcome you to our study and our look at the issue of preterism. First of all, let me just ask you a series of short questions, and then you can jump in at any point and carry forward. But what does the word mean, preterism?
Okay, well, preterism is a Latin word. That's why it's unfamiliar to people. And the Latin word preterism means past or gone by. From that word, I think it's preter, we get the word preterism. So preterism is the belief system that a lot of the prophecies that we have in our Bible that you and I would look at as futuristic. They haven't happened yet. We would call that eschatological. The preterists would say, no, these things already transpired. They typically, there's different varieties of preterism, but the one that's in vogue today is the idea that most of these prophecies, if not all, in some cases, were fulfilled in the events of AD 70, when the Romans invaded Jerusalem in AD 70, and I think Josephus says about a million Jews, I believe, were killed during that time period. And so they would date the book of Revelation early, about AD 65, and make Revelation into a prophecy which was fulfilled just a few years later in the events of AD 70.
Okay, so one of the things that the most burning statement that a preterist would make from our standpoint that we would certainly disagree with is that the second coming took place at 70 AD. So all the prophecies about Christ coming back to reign and rule and the kingdom, all that's already taken place, right?
Yeah, well, there's different types of preterism. There's a viewpoint called full preterism, which puts everything in AD 70. There's not one shred of futuristic prophecy left. Even the eternal state began in AD 70.
The eternal state began in AD 70.
I miss the good old days when we used to argue about the kingdom. Are we in the kingdom? Now the debate is, are we in the eternal state? And these people call themselves transmillennialists.
Explain that.
That means the eternal state, we're in it now. It started in AD 70. So it's not something that's yet future, it's something that's happening now.
Why do they want to get rid of, this is a psychological question.
But let me just real quickly define one more thing to get to your question. There's another variety of preterism called partial preterism. Its leading exponent, Kenneth Gentry, takes Revelation chapter 20, verses 7 through 15, futuristically. So we have a future rebellion at the end of the kingdom. We're in the kingdom right now, but there's a future rebellion. There'll be a future parousia or coming of Christ. He gets that from Revelation 20, verse 9, where fire comes down from heaven. That's where he puts the second coming.
Okay.
And there'll be a future resurrection of the unsaved, and then there'll be a future judgment. He gets that from Revelation 20, verses 7 through 15. Other than that, though, everything's in the past.
So we're in the kingdom now.
So you're either dealing with a full preterism, which puts everything in the past, or you're dealing with a partial preterism, which basically takes, the way Gentry espouses it, Revelation 20, verses 7 through 15, futuristically, and everything else is in the past. So those are the two main branches.
Okay.
One of these types of preterism is heretical. I'm just going to tell you right now, we all agree on this, that full preterism is heretical.
Yes.
If you are a full preterist, you are not within the confines of Orthodox Christianity, because you're going against all the creeds and councils of church history. Everybody, no matter what their persuasion is, eschatologically, everyone has believed that Christ is going to come back.
Yes.
So if you don't believe in any form of a future coming, then you're not Christian.
Yes, right.
I mean, let's just be honest.
Right.
You are in what we call heretical. Partial preterism is Orthodox, but it's just barely hanging in there as Orthodox. Because they still are consistent with the creeds. You know, they still hold to a future coming. But the reason they're just barely Orthodox is because their interpretation is inconsistent.
Yes.
In other words, why does all of a sudden Revelation 20... verses 7 to 15 become literal?
Wow.
when the rest of the book of Revelation is not literal.
Wow, wow, wow. All right, now let me ask you two questions, and this may occupy the whole rest of the CD.
Sure.
But to me, these are the most important questions. Why, first of all, how could anyone take the literal promises of Christ's return and say they've already happened? Number two, why would they even want to do this? Two questions. How can they do it? Number two, why do they do it?
Well, regarding how, one of their chief arguments is these little phrases. You actually wrote something about this in a book called End Times Controversy.
Mm-hmm.
These so-called timing texts that
yes.
appear
right.
in Revelation chapter 1 and Revelation chapter 22. These little terms... shortly, quickly, or near.
Yes.
Takas, engis, and mellow.
Mm-hmm.
And so they believe, well, shortly means shortly. They said, you know, we're going to interpret that literally.
Mm-hmm.
They don't interpret anything else literally, but they interpret those phrases literally. And so they believe that those phrases demand that the prophecy had to have been fulfilled in the lifetimes of the apostles.
Wow, mercy.
Now, they allegorize the rest of the book
yes.
to get it to fit. You know, how can you get the global events of Revelation into the local events of AD 70? You have to follow what Charlie Clough calls the ram, jam, and cram method. You know, you have to radically spiritualize the text to get that to work. But they believe they have the literary license to do that because of those little phrases
yes.
that appear at the beginning and end.
Right.
And this is why earlier I said that partial preterists are barely Orthodox. Because why don't they, if they're going to attach that type of meaning to those phrases when they appear in Revelation 1, why don't they attach the same meaning to those phrases when they show up again in Revelation 22?
Yes.
Consistency
yes.
demands you become a heretical full preterist. But if you want to stay Orthodox, you got to be inconsistent.
Right, right.
In how you're interpreting these so-called timing texts that show up at the beginning and end of Revelation. So that's sort of, that's basically to answer your what was your first question?
How do they get it?
Would be one reason. And then why? Oh, there's a lot of reasons why people are attracted to preterism. One reason is there's a lot of, I hate to say it this way, but there's a lot of Jew hating.
Yes, yes.
When I read Hank Hanegraaff's book, who's a partial preterist.
Yes.
He keeps saying I'm not a partial preterist, but he says all the things partial preterists say. You know, when I read his book, I detected a real animosity towards the idea that one day there's going to be a Jewish kingdom on planet Earth. He doesn't like that at all. And so if you want to get rid of the Jews in God's program, you know what I mean by get rid of the Jews?
Sure.
Not the idea that a Jew can get saved, he's not saying that, but the idea of a Jewish kingdom
right.
that Israel will once again be the center of the world
right.
in the thousand-year reign. If you don't like that, preterism is a very easy escape from that. So that would be one answer.
Right.
Another answer to your question on why is... Hal Lindsey came along and published this book called The Late Great Planet Earth, which you did a film about that,
yes,
I think,
right.
With Hal Lindsey. And that book just exploded. No one anticipated how much it would sell, how much influence it would have. Tim LaHaye comes along and does the same thing through a fiction series called the Left Behind series, and that explodes in the same way Hal Lindsey's book explodes.
Right.
And those books, The Late Great Planet Earth and The Left Behind, are a dispensational, which is our perspective, point of view.
Yes.
And so people, they're always looking for an antidote to that. They want to react against it, but they're not sure which eschatological system to embrace. So a lot of people that are just Lindsey bashers or LaHaye haters gravitate towards preterism, because preterism is the antithesis of what Lindsey and LaHaye were saying.
Wow.
So that would be another reason as to why.
Your answer is so revealing psychologically of where these people are coming from. Of course, they would not admit this.
No, they wouldn't.
But this is the only thing that makes sense from, and I'm trying to understand them.
Right.
That they've got to be reacting on some, for some reason.
Right.
Because preterism, to me, is not logical. It's not biblical. It's not. You can't sustain it interpretive wise, I don't think. And the only answer you come up with is a psychological answer. They just have a hatred somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They just can't stand the idea of the earthly kingdom of Christ, i.e. the Jewish people restored to a place of blessing. They can't stand it.
One other thing you mentioned before we started taping is R.C. Sproul, who's also a partial preterist, was attracted to preterism because he felt it answered some of his liberal professors.
Yes.
That he studied under. They would say, well, Jesus made a mistake. You know, Jesus said, this generation, all of these signs will transpire. And his liberal professor said, well, Jesus made a mistake. And so Sproul is attracted to preterism as an answer to his liberal professors.
Yes.
Jesus did not make a mistake. He did come back invisibly, according to Sproul's thinking, in the events of AD 70, although there'll still yet be a future coming.
Right.
And so, and Sproul says this in his book, The Last Days According to Jesus. Anybody can go get the book and read it. He basically says he was attracted to preterism because it was an answer to his liberal professors.
Yes.
And so my response to that is, why do we care? Why do I need to worry what liberals think?
Right.
They've already rejected Christ. Why do I need to pacify them?
Right.
And the answer, as our friend Thomas Eye says, is... He says the answer to unbelief is not more unbelief, is it? So those are some answers to the why question.
I mentioned this before we began, that and I'm sure this is, you study this far more than anybody else around with your dissertation, but I believe that Acts 1, to me, this is the greatest answer to the fact, again, I want the audience to listen carefully to what's going on here. They're saying that Christ came back in 70 A.D., the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Now, they have to say, correct me, Andy, but they say, well, he came back spiritually speaking, not literally speaking, correct? This is what they're arguing.
Yeah, well, just for clarification, the partial preterist believes Christ comes three times.
Okay.
Once in the incarnation, the first coming, he came again invisibly through the armies of Rome, and to destroy the nation of Israel in AD 70. That was the second coming.
But he came invisibly. Spiritually.
And according to most of their systems, there will be a bodily parousia at the end of the kingdom, which we're in now. So the partial preterist still believes in yet a physical return of Christ, but the full preterist does not.
Well, before I get to the Acts passage, why do they want to cling to the idea that he came back invisibly or spiritually in 70 A.D.? Why do they want to cling to that if they still argue that he's going to come back literally, in the future?
Well, because it allows you to put most of Revelation in the past.
Okay.
And
okay.
One other thing I mentioned on the why question, there's a big school of thought today called theonomy or postmillennialism, which is the idea of Christian progress, that the Christians will actually make progress through the preaching of the gospel. The world will become Christianized. I mean, I'm not sure what newspapers they're reading, because every time I pick up the paper, the world is not becoming Christianized. It's becoming Islamicized, if anything. But and it's the idea of progress. We're going to usher in the kingdom. We're going to set it up. we're going to fix everything, and then Jesus will come back after we've got it all set up for him, and he'll find everything in apple pie order, and then he'll come back. So we're going to set up the kingdom before Christ even comes back.
Right.
Now, what if you believe that, if that's your assumption, what's standing in your way?
Right.
Well, the whole book of Revelation is
right.
standing in your way. Well, you've got to do something to get rid of the book of Revelation. Well, what can you do? Well, one of the things you could do is you could just put most of it in the past.
Right.
So the idea of, and a lot of your homeschool movement, Christian activists in politics, you know, they believe that what's holding back true Christianization of the culture is us.
Dispensationalists.
We keep talking about an antichrist that's coming and a rapture, and they say that messes everybody's attention or takes everybody's attention away from Christianizing culture.
Wow.
So you and I are standing in the way of theonomy or postmillennialism, our view. So that's why they're always attacking us. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Okay. I mean, the more we talk about a future antichrist in their minds, the more it deflates the idea of the Christianization of culture.
Yes.
So they've got to do something with our view.
Right.
And one of the great ways things they can do is just put it in the past.
Right.
So
right.
Those are all answers to the why question.
This passage, to me, when Christ went up from the disciples, in a very simplistic way, answers the issue, did Christ return invisibly or spiritually in 70 A.D.? The angels, the two men, they're described as the two men, who come to the disciples as the Lord was leaving the disciples. Verse 9, chapter 1, after he had said these things, Christ had said these things, he was lifted up. While they were looking on, a cloud received him out of their sight. Notice this, out of their sight, the cloud received him. As they were gazing intently into the sky, while he was departing, behold, two men in white clothing stood beside them. And they also said, men of Galilee, that is the angelic beings, said, men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into the sky? Notice, look while they were looking. You're looking into the sky. That's very important. This Jesus who's been taken up from you to heaven will come in just the same way as you have watched him go into heaven. He'll come just the same way. Physically, actually, visibly. That's how he went. This is how he's coming back. Physically, actually. And I don't know how they could fight that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's where they could place this. I guess they could throw this at the very end of history.
Well, even if they do that, the angels don't say, Jesus is coming back in part one. He's coming
right.
back invisibly. But
right.
part two is visibly. No, the only coming of Christ that we know of is the physical, visible,
right.
bodily appearance of Christ. By the way, they make fun of us all the time because we divide the coming of Christ into two phases, A, the rapture, and B, the second advent. And they're constantly maligning us on the internet and other forums. But aren't they doing the same thing? They've
yes.
just divided the
right.
coming of Christ once invisibly in AD 70 and once at the end of the kingdom. They're,
right.
they're no different than we are
right.
in that sense.
Right, right. The rapture is called a parousia, which means it's a coming. But also, the rapture makes it clear that Christ's feet do not touch the earth. We are caught up to him.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts the rapture into a different category, even though it's called a coming. But it puts it into a whole different framework. All right, let's go back and find out, when did preterism start? Give us a little take on history here. Well, let's do it this way. There'd be two things you could answer. There was an old preterism, and then the new preterism. When did the old preterism start, and why?
Well, church history is probably not my strongest suit, but I mean, basically, as I understand it, the older preterism argued that the church had two enemies. Number one, the Jews. That would be the unbelieving Jews. And number two, Rome. So basically what they do is they take the first half of Revelation and they say that applies to the fall of the first enemy of the church, Jerusalem. That would be AD 70.
Right.
So that takes you about to Revelation chapter 11, right around there, the end of chapter 11. And then beginning in chapter 12, they say the rest of the book deals with the fall of God's or the church's second enemy, which would be Rome. when did Rome fall? 476, something in there, AD 476. So they say the second half of the book deals with that subject, the fall of Rome. So that would be an older variety of preterism. It's hard to find anybody that's alive today that believes that. I think I found somebody whose name is familiar to our listeners, a guy by the name of Jay Adams, who really has done great work in the area of counseling, getting Christian counseling is based on the Bible. But Jay Adams writes this little tiny book on preterism, arguing for this preterist point of view. It's very, very interesting. But that form of preterism is pretty much dead and gone. The dominant preterism that's in view today is the idea that all of the book of Revelation concerns AD 70, with the partial preterist coming along and saying there's still a parousia, there's still a resurrection of the damned, and there's still a future judgment.
Right.
But the whole thing is connected to AD 70. I don't think preterism, I don't think it's possible to show too much of this, if any, in the early church.
All right. Why do people gravitate toward it? Now, you've given some reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One is anti-Semitism, disliking us as dispensationalists and so forth. But deeper than that, why are people reacting against... Why don't people give dispensationalists, that's us, and premillennialists, and premillennial means that we believe that Christ comes to establish his kingdom, why don't they give us a hearing? Why do they automatically just hate our very living guts, if you will? They just can't stand us. They just won't listen to any reasoning, and more people are going in that direction. They're going to the preterist camp without, in my opinion, giving a fair hearing to what we represent. Why? Why is this popular? Why would people want to jettison something that you and I would say is more obvious, is more plain? Why would they want to run away from that to go to preterism?
Well, the more I'm looking into it, the more it seems to me that the agenda or the goals or the motives of people are political. They take a particular point of view on the Middle East conflict. And they don't like the idea where the United States is always siding with Israel. I mean, the reason I side with Israel, the reason you side with Israel, is because we believe God has a future for Israel.
Right.
And we get that from a literal reading of the Bible.
Yeah.
They look at us as influencing our government to always side with Israel as something that's holding up peace in the Middle East. So the price of oil has gone up. Well, whose fault is that? That's our fault.
It's our fault.
Because the Arabs are reacting against Israel.
Right.
And if we would just let them eradicate Israel, I think, the way they think, the price of oil would go down. So the price of oil is up because of dispensationalists. The economy that's dependent upon oil has gone down because of dispensationalists. There's unrest in the Middle East because of dispensationalists. I think it was you telling me on the phone that some of our evangelical, I don't even want to call them pastors, I would call them sort of unorthodox teachers, like Rick Warren,
yes,
and who's the emergent church fellow, McLaren, are blaming dispensationalists for the problems in the Middle East.
Yes.
So a lot of it is related to a political belief system.
Yes.
So that would be another reason why people gravitate towards this.
It's absolutely unbelievable. And it's galloping. Why do you think it's galloping? I guess we could take all the answers you've given and say that's why it's galloping. But is there another reason that you could say this is why it's... I guess you could pretty well stated it, though, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, now I'm giving you my verse, the passage of Scripture that I think are very important. What are some of your verses that you would use that would say this really blasts preterism?
Well, the whole book of Revelation. I mean, it's just so silly to contend that these things already happened.
Yeah.
I mean, just a few examples. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 15. It talks about a one-world system in the last days. It talks about its influence. And look what it says. He said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, languages, or tongues. In other words, this system is not confined to a nation. It's not talking about the local events of AD 70. It's talking about something that covers the face of the whole earth.
Yes.
Now, those same categories, peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues, if you look at Revelation 5, verse 9, it's there we learn that those are the groups for whom Christ died. It says in Revelation 5, verse 9, they sang a new song, "Worthy you to take the book and to break its seals, for you were slain and purchased for God with your blood men from every..." Here's the same terms. Tribe, tongue, people, nation. Christ died for the whole world. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." 1 John 2, verse 2, "He died for the whole world." So if these terms communicate global influence in Revelation 5, verse 9, how can those identical terms, just a few chapters later, communicate a local influence?
Right.
It's inconsistent to believe something like that.
Right.
And you find this expression constantly, this expression of globalism constantly throughout the book of Revelation. For example, in Revelation 13, verse 16, it says, "He causes all, the small and the great." You know what that is? It's a merism. A merism is a figure of speech where you take two opposites and it communicates everything in between. The small and the great is a way of communicating the totality of humanity. The rich and the poor, the free and the slaves, to be given a mark on the right hand or the forehead. I mean, clearly this is not talking about a local event. And any fair-minded reading of this book communicates that. It's interesting that these phrases that I'm reading here show up again in the futuristic section of the partial preterist system. You'll find these same phrases in Revelation 20, verses 7 through 15, that partial preterists understand as yet future. For example, it says in Revelation 20, verse 12, "I saw the dead, the small and the great, standing before the throne, and the books were open." And the partial preterist says that's talking about a future global judgment. Well, why can't those exact same phrases communicate globalism in Revelation 13?
Right, right.
So it's a wild, they're wildly inconsistent in their hermeneutic. So these expressions of globalism communicate something that has not yet happened.
I guess another reason that people gravitate to preterism is because some high visibility folks, R.C. Sproul, yeah, Hank Hanegraaff, hold to partial preterism. So therefore, if those guys say it, then it must be true.
Yeah,
that's another another argument.
Yeah, that was a major the conversion of Sproul and Hanegraaff to fellows that have a radio influence. The conversion of Sproul and Hanegraaff to preterism was a huge boon, if you will, for their movement.
Right. And you know, I get the feeling, and I'd like for you to address this, that on radio and maybe television, except for the ministry of St. Hal Lindsey, they don't hear strong teaching on dispensationalism and premillennialism. And so, you know, these two guys are very popular.
Mm-hmm.
So they out to numbers or outwhip us in terms of their popularity.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have on radio others who are coming along and answering.
Right. That's exactly right. And even some of the guys that we do have, I love those guys, but they sometimes have a tendency to focus more on current events than the Scripture.
Right.
I'm not against. We've done several CDs on current events, but we need to really anchor our people in the Word of God.
Yes.
And show them from the text where we get these ideas.
Right, right.
And so we don't have a lot of strong Bible teaching on the air. One other thing, you asked me the question of why. Let me give you something else that came to mind. There's a huge movement, and I didn't even understand the full ramifications of this until I went into seminary. There's a huge movement amongst scholarship to argue that the book of Revelation is a special type of literature that you cannot approach literally. They would say there's so much symbolic material in here that it cannot be interpreted literally. And so the idea of a consistent, literal, grammatical, historical approach to the whole Bible, including prophecy, including the book of Revelation, is looked at in the minds of some people as something that's very much passé.
Yes.
Something that you cannot do, something that, in fact, is impossible. And we're not denying that Revelation has symbols in it, but when we approach symbolic material, the text will tell us it's a symbol.
Right.
You know, Revelation 12, verse 1, and I saw a great sign. It appeared in heaven. Oh, the word sign is a clue to me that we're dealing with a symbol here.
Right.
Revelation chapter 11 and verse 8 says, and their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is mystically called Sodom and Egypt. Oh, the word mystically gives me a hint. And so, you know, our hermeneutic is such that we try to interpret words or phrases in their ordinary sense, except when we encounter a conspicuous symbol or figure of speech in the text.
Right.
We do that through the whole Bible.
Right.
We just have to work a little harder at it in Revelation.
Yes.
Because there's more symbolic content. But even so, we're still using the same general hermeneutic.
Yes.
Literal, unless a textual clue tells us to do otherwise. And scholars kind of look at that as a naive approach. You're kind of a member of the Flat Earth Society, you know, if you're looking at. I mean, don't you know, you know, this is apocalyptic in nature and there's a heavy symbolic content here. So the more you move away from a consistent grammatical historical approach, especially in the book of Revelation, the more ideas like preterism start becoming viable.
Yes. Do you see it leveling off, or do you see it? It is growing, but do you see? Let me ask you this question. Wouldn't it be to our advantage the fact of what is happening in the Middle East for us to be able to say, but the Bible makes predictions about the Middle East and the enemies of the Jews will come against them? Wouldn't that give credence to what we're saying, to taking prophecy literally? In other words, while it's happening before our very eyes, how could they be coming along denying it while what we're saying is shaping up, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Well, one reason is because Second Peter tells us that they would. The last days there would come scoffers,
mockers,
following their own lusts, saying, "Where is the promise of his coming?" One of the things that's interesting is that the lay people typically are with us.
Yes.
I live in Houston. I went and spoke at a large Sunday school class in Houston, and this is a Presbyterian church.
Yes.
And I was asked by somebody to do this at the last minute, and the assignment I was given was Psalm 2. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going into this Presbyterian church, you know, Presbyterians. You know, God bless the Presbyterians. I call them the frozen chosen. But they have a real propensity not to hold to a dispensational perspective on prophecy, at least the leadership. So I'm saying, man, I'm going to go teach Psalm 2. I'm going to talk about Jesus reigning on Mount Zion and all of these things. And I wonder how that's going to go over. Well, lo and behold, the lay people responded beautifully to it.
Yes.
See, the lay people, regardless of where they, what denomination they're in, generally hold to our view, and the reason they hold to it is because it's the easiest to understand.
Right. Yes.
You don't have to be a scholar to understand our view.
Right.
You just have to be consistent in your approach to the Bible.
Right. Right.
These scholars, on the other hand, are moving aggressively away from our view. It's kind of looked at as overly simplistic. You know, they use these little pejorative terms like wooden literalism.
Yes.
And things like that. Not genre sensitive.
Right.
You know, those types of ideas. So as scholarship is moving away from dispensationalism, the lay people, I think to their credit, are generally moving in the direction of dispensationalism.
Yes.
And obviously the book sales of Tim LaHaye and Hal Lindsey wouldn't exist unless the lay people were responding to what they were saying.
Right. Okay, coming back to the question I was about to ask
you,
do you see it leveling off? Or are you saying, but I mean, you mm-hmm. already partially answered. You said, no, it's growing. But
amongst the lay people, but amongst our institutions, It is not only, I'm talking about dispensationalism yes. now. Amongst lay people, dispensationalism, at least our view of the end times, is growing.
Yes.
Amongst scholars, and our view of the end times, not preterist view, but our view is dying.
Yes. Yes.
More and more scholars are moving away from it.
And to me,
at the academic levels, preterism and something else called idealism is on the rise.
Yes. You know, explain idealism to folks.
Idealism is a little bit different than preterism. Idealism is the idea that these prophecies have no historical fulfillment at all. They just keep recycling through the ages of history. So, for example, Babylon. Babylon could be Jerusalem in the first century, and it could be Rome that fell. And it could be the Roman Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, and it could be Las Vegas today.
Right.
So there is no actual historical fulfillment of Babylon. It just keeps recycling from age to age to age.
Right.
Now, the reason I don't believe that is because it defies the pattern of prophecy. Isaiah 53, his hands and his feet will be pierced. Psalm 22. He'll be buried in the tomb of a rich man, crucified among thieves. That had an actual historical fulfillment,
right,
didn't it?
Right.
In the person
yes.
of Christ. So why wouldn't the end time prophecies have an actual historical fulfillment?
This is what I was going to bring up. If all prophecy in the past has been fulfilled literally, then why would we expect and they expect the prophecy in the future to be fulfilled literally?
That's a very good question. And that's one of the key planks in our position.
Right, right. Okay, Andy.
By the way, real quickly,
yes.
One of the things you have to move into to come to these sort of different views is you have to involve yourself in what's called a dual hermeneutic. And this is an ancient concept that goes back to Alexandria, Egypt, and it's promoted in church history through people like Origen, and who's the other fellow I'm thinking of?
Philo.
Yeah, Philo, who's a Jew, but Origen, and they came up with this, what we call the allegorical approach, where you take the whole Bible literally except prophecy. Prophecy is non-literal. And that's the only way these systems, like idealism and preterism, really work. You cannot hold to a consistent, literal approach to the whole Bible and be a preterist. It's impossible.
And this is a way, to me, of discrediting the Bible. I mean, it's Dr. Walbert made a statement. He says, you know, we deprecate the Bible when we don't live it and when we don't take it literally.
Yeah.
It's a way of taking the sting out of the literalness of Scripture.
Yeah.
And, boy, you could do anything. To me, it's so subjective.
Right.
You know, if it doesn't mean what it says, then who's to say what it means?
Right.
You and I can have different views, and we could both be right or we could both be wrong, and it
yeah.
doesn't, you know, who knows?
Yeah, the nice thing about being an allegorist is you're never out of a job.
Right.
Because you're the only one who knows what the allegory means. And, you know, so the Reformers said that allegorism is like putty in the hands of the exegete. You can mold it and shape it any way you want.
Yes.
It's, if I can just draw this connection, we spent the last couple CDs talking about the Supreme Court and things of that nature. It's exactly what liberal jurists in the Supreme Court do.
Right.
They don't take the text for what it says. They see it as kind of loosey-goosey. They call it a living document where you can read alien ideas or foreign ideas
right.
Into the text that really aren't there. And that same battle takes place in the realm of biblical interpretation.
Right, right. So, where from here? What?
Oh, by the way, yeah. real quickly, if these guys did in Revelation, okay, if they did in Revelation, what... If they took their strategy of interpretation in the book of Revelation and they did that in Romans, if they did that in the Gospels, they would be rank heretics,
yes.
rank liberals. But because they're dual in their approach, we'll just do it in Revelation, not in the Gospels. They're quasi-orthodox.
Right.
But they only stay quasi-orthodox by being inconsistent in their
right.
own approach.
Right. All right. Let's go. We're still in the same general discussion about preterism, but not really, but in a way we are. But I want to get your view on what you see as the Babylon the harlot. Do you see Babylon the harlot as the nation of Babylon restored? Do you see it as Roman Catholic Church? Do you see Babylon the harlot as Jerusalem? Who is Babylon the harlot to you?
Okay, well, my view is really radical. Are you ready for this?
Okay.
I think Babylon means Babylon.
Okay.
So when it speaks of a city named Babylon in the last days, I expect a city in the very place that both Nimrod and Nebuchadnezzar sought to rule from. Nimrod in the Tower of Babel in Mesopotamia, and Nebuchadnezzar in Neo-Babylonia. I see the same thing emerging, and that will be the headquarters of the Antichrist in the tribulation period.
Right. Okay. I lean towards, and we've discussed this before, I lean toward the possibility of, though I still believe it's a literal city, and that's not
right.
A question, but it being Rome.
So you believe Babylon means Rome?
No, I think it means Rome. I think it still means Babylon, but I think it's referring to a different state of what Babylon was in terms of all the polytheism and the that whole issue of the false religion that Babylon represented.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say I lean that way, I'm not concrete on it.
Right.
And the reason I do is because I think that there's a possibility of the way it's described and what's going on there that it could be. But at the same time, I recognize, because I'm a literalist,
you know,
I hold to the literal interpretation of Scripture, but I believe that it's and this is probably part of the way this would be taken. Part of the way it would be taken is this whole issue of mystery Babylon, that is a form of Babylon that the Bible hasn't spoken of.
Mm-hmm.
Embedded all this polytheism embedded in Babylon the heart of the book of Revelation. Now again, knock that down. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would say I'm reading here the NASB. You notice that mystery is not in capital letters,
right,
where Babylon is. And I think the NASB has it right, because every time Babylon is referred to in Revelation, it's never called Mystery Babylon. What it is, it's a name, comma, a mystery. Mystery is an apposition to name.
Yes.
And the actual title is Babylon the Great. And every time you study the word Babylon in the whole Bible, Babylon always refers to an actual, you know, geopolitical place on planet Earth. It never refers to just a spiritual system.
See, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're talking about a literal city. I don't doubt that.
Right,
the city of Rome.
You're placing it in Rome. I'm placing it in Babylon.
Right, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you're probably right. I'm not dogmatic about it. But
well, another ingredient to this is there's a lot of prophecy in the Old Testament, such as Jeremiah 15:53, and Isaiah 13:14. In Zechariah 5, verses 5 to 11, which seems to indicate that all of everything God said would happen to Babylon hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, it says when she falls, she'll be made permanently desolate, which obviously hasn't happened because there's people living in Babylon today.
Yes.
So there's a certain sense in which the Old Testament gives us an expectation that Babylon has to be brought back to life to be destroyed in the specific manner that God said she would. And it's interesting that a lot of Jeremiah 15:51 shows up right here in Revelation 17 and 18.
Right.
I recommend to people Charles Dyer's BibSack articles in 1987, where he documents a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of another impetus of the literal Babylon view. But, you know, we'll just this is an in-house, like you say, thing,
right,
where good people of goodwill can disagree. I mean, neither of us are saying this is ancient Jerusalem,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Right.
So we're
both
futurists.
Right.
We're just putting the location at different places of Babylon. And so, you know, a lot of it we'll just have to see what happens in the end. But, you know, I do respect the Rome view. Dave Hunt, you know, wrote a whole book about it. I like Dave Hunt. I think he's got some important things to say about Roman Catholicism.
Yes.
I just don't think he's interpreting this passage the way I would, Revelation 17 and 18.
Right. Okay, what else do we want to say about preterism? Because, again, it's a force to be reckoned with. It's on us. Mm-hmm. It's popular. It's pulling people away from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Full preterist, as you say, and I would agree with you, is virtually heretical because it denies the actual return of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So what else do we want to say about it? Because people may be running into this more than they can imagine in the future.
Well, I always like to just go back to the biblical covenants. You really have to do a number with those biblical covenants to say that God is finished with the nation of Israel.
Right.
And we might want to talk about replacement theology, because that's what preterism really is.
Okay, explain replacement theology.
It's the idea that there is no future national plan and program for the Jews.
So the church has replaced Israel.
Yeah, the church has replaced Israel. The church is the new Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And all of Israel's blessings, as promised in the Abrahamic covenant, have been transferred to the church.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting they never transfer the curses. Have you noticed that? They only transfer the blessings. You know, Deuteronomy 28 gives curses, you know, if Israel disobeys.
But what they have to do is to allegorize the land promises, right? They have to allegorize the land promises. How do you apply the land promises to the church? You know, I'm going to restore them to their land. So.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really, with those land promises, when we go back to Genesis 15, verses 18 through 21, we basically learn that Israel is promised a plot of land from very near the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
The Wadi al-Irish is where most people say it starts, but it's very near the Nile.
Right.
All the way into what we would call modern-day Iraq, into the Euphrates.
Yes.
So from the Nile, literally from almost near the Nile in Egypt, all the way to the Euphrates. And you look at those dimensions, and that has never been fulfilled in Israel's history.
No.
Even in Solomon's reign, Solomon got the closest to those land dimensions, but he didn't even quite make it.
No.
And the Abrahamic covenant promises that the nation would enjoy the land forever.
Yes.
Solomon didn't possess the land forever.
No.
In fact, the nation is evicted from the land not too long after Solomon, you know, a few centuries after the Solomonic era.
Right.
So you've got three outs as a replacement theologian. You could say, well, the Abrahamic covenant is conditional. Israel didn't fulfill her obligations, so she's been cut off. It's a very hard argument to make, because when God entered into the covenant with Abram, God put Abram to sleep.
Right.
And God alone passed through the animal pieces. The way covenants were entered into in the ancient Near East world is animals were cut in half. They were put in two rows. And both parties to the covenant pass through the animal rows.
Right.
And that signified that if I don't fulfill my obligations under the covenant, let me be cut in half like these animals. It was
right.
it was very heavy in terms of its significance. So what happened in Genesis 15 is God put Abram asleep. And God alone, as represented by the oven and the torch, passed through the animal pieces.
Right. Right.
So it's very hard to argue that Israel somehow dropped the ball and she's been cut off. She did drop the ball, but she's not cut off because the covenant is unconditional.
Right.
Now, the second out that the replacement theologian has is he can say, well, these promises have been fulfilled in the days of Solomon. But as we mentioned before, Solomon did not possess the land forever.
Right.
The third out is the one you were talking about, how the land promises become spiritualized to the church. And so what you have to do is you have to adopt an allegorical, you called it a non-literal approach to the land promises.
Right.
So other things in Genesis are literal. Everybody says Abraham was literal. It's a literal character.
Right.
Sarah was literal. Isaac was literal. Abraham came from the Ur of the Chaldeans. That's a literal place. But what about these land promises from Abraham, from the Euphrates, from the Nile to the Euphrates. Oh, those are not literal. So you get back to a dual hermeneutic.
Yes, right.
I can't remember what your original question was, but I hope I answered.
No, you have. No. And I would say the replacement theology is, and by the way, let's give some tests. How do we know a church is into replacement theology, either in actuality or by just the way that they handle the text? And I would say that if you go to a church and you never hear prophecy,
yes,
you never hear prophecy, or if you hear the fact that we are building the kingdom, or we are the kingdom, then you're in a church that has said God's through with the
yes.
Jews.
If you keep calling yourself the kingdom,
right,
then the chances are, I mean, we don't know for sure, you have to, it's a warning sign, let's put it that
right.
way. You have to
right.
follow up and ask questions. It could be you're in a church that teaches replacement theology. Here's another sign. If you ask the leadership, what is the significance of the modern state of Israel?
Yes. Right.
And they say, well, it's just a coincidence. Mm-hmm. It's got nothing to do with Bible prophecy. The Jews are in the land today, and it has nothing to do with God's program. That's a major warning.
Absolutely.
Sign.
Yes. You have moved from North Dallas. We used to live up in North
mm-hmm.
Dallas, and I understand that many good churches up there that used to be very strong as Bible teaching churches, many of the pastors now say, well, we don't want to talk on prophecy because it's divisive. We don't want to cause problems. We don't want new people to get confused or coming to the church. So another thing that Satan uses, a device that he uses, is to stonewall people from getting into Bible prophecy. And if our Bible is at least a half prophetic, then how in the world can pastors say we don't want to study Bible prophecy? And that leaves the people ignorant. It leaves them open for error in terms of understanding the future.
Absolutely. The big cry, human cry today is, how can we be unified? And how can we get people in the door?
Yes.
And there's a fear amongst pastors that Bible prophecy divides.
Yes.
It confuses. And it scares people. And so they see it as sort of antithetical to church growth
right.
and a healthy church. That's how they think.
Right.
But if God has something to say on it, shouldn't that
right.
take preeminence?
Absolutely.
Tell me a doctrine in the Bible that hasn't divided. A doctrine in the Bible that hasn't divided.
Right.
Things.
Right.
You know, people say prophecy is controversial. Well, the whole Bible is controversial. And if you don't want to be controversial, you might as well just not teach from the Bible at all. So you're right. There is a tremendous kind of a spirit of prophetic agnosticism
mm-hmm.
has descended upon us, where people are trying to say, well, we just don't know for sure.
Right. And you know what's sickening about this is that generally those pastors we're talking about, they do know prophecy. They do know the Bible. They've been trained, generally, not all of them, but they've been trained well. And what they're doing, they're just walking away from their own integrity, because what they know is true, what's right, they're just walking away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be controversial.
Yeah.
What do you want to say in conclusion about preterism? Because again, I hope we have helped folks realize it's an important issue, an important word. A full preterist says that Christ came back invisibly or spiritually mm-hmm. In 70 AD. Again, as Andy's pointed out, there are those who say, well, yeah, but he's still going to come back literally. So they're kind of split. They have a dual preteristic approach. So what would you want to say in conclusion about preterism?
Well, I would say, in general, there are two sections of the Bible that are on the chopping block today. I'm not talking about liberalism. I'm talking about within the evangelical church. People, for whatever reason, are trying to lop off Genesis 1 through 11.
Mm-hmm.
And people, for whatever reason, are trying to lop off Revelation, eschatological, end
right.
times prophecy. Now, think about that. If you say Genesis 1 through 11, we can't know for sure, and prophetic truth, we can't say we know for sure, then we don't know where we came from, right?
Right.
And we don't know where we're going. Now, if we don't know where we came from, and if we don't know where we're going, what do we have to focus on? Right here.
Right.
So that's why most of the sermons that you hear today are focused on the here and now.
Right.
Practical advice for fixing your business, practical advice for relationships, how to get over your father who yelled at you because you didn't put enough gasoline in the lawnmower. You know, those, these types of pragmatic sermons.
Right.
Well, why is it all we hear today is practical advice about how to live? Because we don't want to talk about where we came from, where we're going. So if you're not going to talk about that, the only thing you've left to focus on is right here. And so you become very earthly focused. And that's a general observation I would make. And that's why these issues about preterism, eschatology, are significant. And, you know, you better think as a church very carefully what you believe about prophecy.
Yes.
And the reason you should think carefully about it is because it will shape what you think the church should be doing.
Right, yes.
If you think we are the new Israel, or we are the kingdom, or we are setting up the kingdom,
right,
that will change what you think the church is about.
Right.
You become focused upon kingdom causes.
Yes.
You know, like the emergent church, their cause is the environment.
Right.
Fixing the world.
Right.
Or getting rid of racism.
Right.
Or getting rid of poverty. When in reality, the primary focus of the church is to reach and teach.
Right.
Is to fulfill the Great Commission. Why? Because this world, although we can restrain evil to a certain extent, this world is not our home.
No.
And you lose the concept of being a pilgrim.
Yes.
That you're Peter in his epistles talks about how we're on a sojourn, and our body is just a tent. You know, you put up a tent to temporarily, is a temporary house.
Right.
That's all we are. We're temporarily passing through. But you lose that emphasis when you get rid of prophecy.
Right.
And you lose the emphasis of what the church should be doing because you're confusing church and kingdom.
I hope everyone listening is listening very carefully because this is extremely important. We can become so earthbound, and yet if we want to be practical, but at the same time we can become so earthbound that our eyes get off of the spiritual things that are to drive us and to keep us motivated. It's very easy to get our eyes off of these things and have no orientation. You know, as a lawyer, I'm sure you took many courses in law school about theoretical subjects that you never would touch again. But if you didn't have those courses, you would not have a good orientation of what law is all about.
Sure, that's good.
And there's, I have my pilot's license. There's many things that I learned about flying that I never used again, but it was an orientation to what in the world is flying all about. If you don't have that, then you're only partly educated. And we need to be thoroughly biblically educated to fully understand how we got here, as you say, why we're here, and where we're going. And it will really drastically affect the believer who does not compute these things. It'll drastically affect how they live the Christian life, how they see the church, how they see themselves. And it's a terrible... I don't see how people who just take Bible prophecy and just trash all of it, I don't know how they can stand it because they have no idea where is God taking all this. What's God doing with us? What's God doing with the church? Where is it all going? What's eternity about? What am I supposed to be now that I'm here as to where I'm going? And they actually put those things aside. And I don't know how people stand it to have no idea. And, you know, they make the old joke, well, I'm a pan-millennialist, so this all pan out in the end. That's the silliest joke in the world. To say that, well, we just can't know, so we're pan-millennialists.
Would they do that with the Trinity?
They would, yeah.
I'm a pan-virgin birth. I'm a pan-crucifixion, resurrection Christ.
It'll just all work out.
Yeah, I mean, what a pompous, lazy attitude to take to a major realm of doctrine.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I don't see how a pastor who is commissioned to teach the full counsel of God, the whole Bible, can say that even jokingly and not say, if I don't know anything about prophecy, I need to study it. I need to get this straight in my mind. But to ignore it and just to say it'll go away, to me, is just is stupid. Well, our time is gone. Andy, I want to thank you for this, and we're going to get into this some more and look more at preterism, and especially as we try to see what its significance is for us today. We'll have another session at some future point on preterism. I want to thank you all for listening and for being with us on this gathering storm. And this is about a gathering storm, and so is the last ones that we did. Looking at our nation with the new administration and where's it all going, this is a gathering storm, folks. And I hope that this CD will be helping you in your Christian walk. And thank you for listening.